Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association.
This is episode 76 of Text Messages, Life After High School. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. If you're a person who works with teens, you probably know that teens like to read up. That means choosing books where the main character is just a few years older than they are, and then reading in order to imagine what their life might become. It's why middle school kids like to read about high school, and freshmen like to read about senior year. For older teens, reading up means reading about life after high school. Maybe that means going to college, or maybe it means something else. Whatever the scenario, reading in this way is a valuable thing to do. It gives teens a chance to explore possible futures and begin planning for adulthood. Watching fictional characters make big decisions about what they want for themselves can help teens get ready to make those same decisions in their own lives. The books you'll hear about in this episode give teens many ways of reading up. Each one features teens who are envisioning or living life on their own. Some are in college or waiting for it to begin, while others are deciding that college is not for them. Instead, they enlist in the military, embark on road trips, or just take time off from school in general. You'll meet special needs teens who find support in assisted living arrangements, as well as teens whose futures are on hold while they serve time in juvenile detention. Together, these books show teens the range of paths to adulthood and the struggles that are a natural part of the process. The first set of books I want to tell you about feature teens who are either in college or actively preparing to go. Readers who want an authentic portrait of navigating freshman year couldn't start with a better book than Rainbow Rowell's Fangirl. When we first meet main character Kath, she's in the midst of her angst-filled first day at the University of Nebraska, moving boxes into her dorm room, meeting her roommate, and teetering on the edge of an emotional meltdown. There's nothing wrong with Kath. She's funny, she's smart, and she's a brilliant writer of Harry Potter-style fan fiction. But she's also very anxious about being in college. Her twin sister and best friend, Ren, has decided not to live with her, so Kath is on her own in more ways than she expected to be, and the aloneness is pretty awful. Going in the dining hall is so scary, she resolves to make meals out of the protein bar she stores under her bed. As for parties, they might as well be happening in some other universe. But that's okay. Writing fan fiction keeps Kath grounded. Rest assured that it doesn't take long for things to get better for Kath. Her intimidating upperclassman roommate, Reagan, is nicer than she appears. There's an intro to fiction writing class that gives her a place to shine academically. And there are attractive boys to get to know. But college is never simply all good or all bad. Kath also experiences stumbles and disappointments, embarrassments and failures. What makes Fangirl so good and so memorable is that it's a novel about all the layers of Kath's freshman year. Writing, falling in love, messing up in school, and then making things right again. It's about managing anxiety and forging new relationships, both in college and back at home. Best of all, it's about unapologetically nurturing a passion for what you love, no matter how nerdy it seems to other people. Leave any one of these things out, and you just wouldn't capture the full intensity of what freshman year is like. Ultimately, Fangirl is a happy, hopeful book. I loved it because of the characters and because every note rang true. If the start of freshman year comes with its share of drama, the summer before freshman year does too. Sarah Zarr and Tara Altobrando explore how that summer plays out for two girls on opposite coasts in their co-authored novel, Roomies. Here the story begins when the College Housing Department at UC Berkeley sends out freshman roommate assignments. When the email reaches EB in New Jersey, she's ecstatic. The summer has barely begun, but already she can't wait to escape life with her divorced real estate agent mom. She's an only child who's yearning for the camaraderie of a roommate, so she fires off a gushing e-introduction. Out in San Francisco, Lauren is less than thrilled. The oldest of six kids, she asked for a single. It's not EB's fault that her request was denied, but there's no way Lauren can summon up the same level of enthusiasm for her new roommate. Thus begins their relationship, halting and guarded, made all the more complicated by the vagaries of email. How much do you say about who you are and what you're going through to a person you've never met but soon will be living with? How much do you read into tone, personal disclosures, and even the timing of electronic messages? Told through parallel storylines, Rumi shows how EB and Lauren each work through the challenges of their last summer at home. It also shows how they begin to confide in one another about shifting high school friendships, ups and downs with their parents, and the surprise of falling in love just as they're about to begin a new life. I especially liked what the layer of communicating by email added to the story. Readers get to see how each girl constructs a persona through words, sometimes writing guardedly and carefully, other times spilling confessions from the gut. Rumi's is a great book to hand to teens on their way to college because of the way it captures and conveys universal emotions, that combination of restlessness, fear, and hope you inevitably feel during the final summer at home before your new life begins. Certainly, there are universals about leaving home for college, but there's no denying that the experience is different if you're a teen with special needs. Say What You Will by Cammie McGovern shows what that process is like for Amy, a high school senior on her way to Stanford. Amy has cerebral palsy, so she needs a walker to get around, and she relies on a computer in order to talk. She's an academic superstar and the darling of her teachers. The problem is, she doesn't have any friends. It's her classmate Matthew who forces her to see this. Once he does, Amy sets a goal for senior year. She will make friends. She convinces her overprotective mother to hire a group of peer helpers whose job will be to do what paraprofessional aides have always done, walk her to class and assist her at lunch, but more importantly, help her make friends. Amy tells her mom that since she's going to college, she needs practice relating to people her age. What no one expects is that Amy will fall in love with Matthew and that Matthew will love Amy back, albeit in secret. Matthew has his own issues, including a paralyzing anxiety disorder and fear of the world in general. For Matthew, love is messy and terrifying. For Amy, it is exhilarating. But there's no love without pain. As Amy prepares to leave for Stanford, not only must she say goodbye to Matthew, she must prepare to function in a new world where there's no one looking out for her. The people at Stanford may think they're doing Amy a favor by setting her up in a single dorm room next to the infirmary, but for Amy, the arrangement is a disaster. Never has she felt more alone. Like so many books in this month's show, Say What You Will is a book that I read in one big gulp. It's a novel about disability, but it's also about emotional intimacy and sex. It's about looking forward to college and then figuring out next steps after the first semester goes horribly wrong. It's about love between two teens who others assume are incapable of love. I was captivated by the courage and honesty of the characters and the book. As I said in the introduction to this month's show, it's important to remember that not all teens want college or are cut out for it. The next set of books feature teens who decide to go a different route after high school. As soon as I heard the premise, I knew I had to get my hands on Carrie Mesrobian's new novel, Perfectly Good White Boy. Reading about a teen who chooses to enlist in the military was something I was eager to do. But the truth is, I would read anything by Carrie Mesrobian. Her books are as emotionally honest as they come. Her writing is totally in your face and gutsy. And her characters are also smarter than they or the people around them realize. That's certainly true of main character Sean. He understands that people who are worth a damn go to college, and he knows that's not him. I didn't exactly come from a family of high rollers or geniuses, he says. His brother runs a tree trimming service. His dad, when he had a job, sold farm equipment. Only his mom went to college, and she became a school social worker. So when people ask Sean what he wants to do after he graduates, he says the Marines because it sounds cool and he can't really think of anything else. For him, senior year is about hooking up with Hallie, a popular girl who graduated a year ahead of him when she's home on breaks from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. It's working at the thrift shop and having conversations with a nerdy girl named Niecy Albertson who gets him in ways that no one else does. It's about dealing with the shame of his life since his mom left his alcoholic dad, their house got foreclosed on, and they moved into the rundown rental. It's about hiding his plan to join the Marines from everyone but Niecy. I love a lot of YA novels, but I have a special love for Perfectly Good White Boy. This is a book that shows how the military recruitment process plays out from start to finish, and how social class plays a role in the futures teens imagine for themselves. It's true that Sean has no idea what he's getting into, but there are no bad guys here. Sean needs direction and purpose, and he finds that when he enlists. This is also a book that shows how college isn't always what it's cracked up to be. As fall semester unfolds, Hallie is clearly falling apart. Sean's the one who's going to be okay, even though his own family members think he's going nowhere. But most importantly, Perfectly Good White Boy is a book that shows how sex, too, plays an important part in figuring out who you are and where you're going. Sean's experiences with Hallie, and then Niecy Albertson, are a mix of lustful, awkward, maddening, hurtful, and beautiful. Carrie Mesrobian just gets it. How all these feelings and experiences are tangled together as teens get ready to leave home, and how much they all matter. Another book that explores what happens when a young man decides he just can't go along with the life that's been planned for him is Barbara Shoup's lovely new novel, Looking for Jack Kerouac. The year is 1964, and the place is upstate Indiana. Main character Paul is supposed to be getting married to Kathy, his high school sweetheart. But even before Paul's mother suddenly and tragically dies, and he bypasses college to take a job at the steel mill, he feels a restlessness inside him. Maybe it was already there before his senior class trip to New York. But when Paul stumbles upon a copy of Jack Kerouac's On the Road in Greenwich Village, the book lights a fire inside him. This sense of ache and wanting that he feels but can't explain. It's not until he meets a guy named Duke at the steel mill, a fellow reader of Kerouac, that he musters the courage to alter the path he's on. The turning point is the night Duke comes to him at the mill with an obituary for Jack Kerouac's sister, which mentions that surviving family members, including Kerouac, live in St. Petersburg, Florida. Duke tells Paul they have to go find Kerouac. The road beckons. It's a crazy idea, but it's the jolt Paul needs to propel him out of a dead-end life. Kathy says if he goes on this trip, it's over between them. So when he does go, he knows he's leaving everything behind. His job, his dad, his younger brother, and Kathy. What follows is a quest to find Kerouac and create a life worth living. There's so much richness to this novel, and it comes from the book's many layers. As a work of historical fiction, Looking for Jack Kerouac is brimming with period details that give readers vivid glimpses of politics and culture during the summer of 1964. There's the civil rights movement, the presidential election, and even the World Series, all filtered through Paul and Duke's quest to find Kerouac. The book is also a love letter to the Beat Generation, a work of storytelling that shows readers the extraordinary impact a novel can have on people's lives. What's more, the story goes behind the scenes to consider the complex human being behind a larger-than-life literary work. Finally, Looking for Jack Kerouac is a classic YA coming-of-age story about young people who are searching for something bigger and deeper than the small-town life they were born to. It's that quest for meaning that gives the book its soulfulness and its eloquence. sometimes teens' plans for the future get derailed by poor choices and bad judgment. Sometimes it's other people's actions that bring a person down. In Steve Watkins' novel Juvie, main character Sadie has everything going for her at the start of her senior year. She's a good student and a talented basketball player with a clear focus on college. It's her older sister Carla who's the problem. Carla's on probation for pot possession and shoplifting. She has a drinking problem, and she's a single mother to 3-year-old Lulu, the niece Sadie adores. Sadie resents Carla's recklessness, but she loves her sister. So when Carla begs Sadie to come along to a party, Sadie agrees, thinking she'll protect Carla and keep her out of trouble. It doesn't take long for things to spin out of control. By the time the night is over, they're caught up in a drug bust. In order to keep Carla out of jail, Sadie takes the blame, having no idea this decision will land her with a 6-month sentence in juvenile detention. What's sobering here is not just the shocking turn of events for Sadie. It's seeing what goes on in juvie once you're there. Strip searches, violent attacks, arbitrary punishments. And it's seeing how hard it is to hang on to your plans and dreams in that environment. Sadie wants to graduate from high school, but how can she when the only schooling opportunities in juvie are GED classes? She wants to play college basketball, but what are her chances when her high school coach has kicked her off the team? How does a young person ever overcome the stigma of having been incarcerated? What I appreciated most about Juvie were the book's moral and ethical nuances. It's easy to feel sorry for Sadie. She's taking the blame for something she didn't do. But as Miss Simper, the warden, tells her, just because you're not guilty doesn't mean you're innocent. Kids are in juvie for all kinds of reasons, but this book reminds us that the line between guilt and innocence isn't clearly drawn. In the end, we're responsible for the decisions we make, no matter how good our intentions. The last book I want to tell you about explores life after high school for the students we often forget to think about, ones in self-contained classrooms who graduate from special ed programs. These are the students with learning disabilities, the ones other people insult with cruel labels like retarded. Gail Giles introduces us to two of them in her new book, Girls Like Us. Main characters Biddy and Quincy are fully aware of how they're viewed by other people. They also know what happened to cause their disabilities. For Quincy, it was being hit in the head with a brick by her mother's boyfriend when she was 6 years old. For Biddy, it was her brain not getting enough oxygen when she was born. These girls may not be able to function the same as other people, but they're still human beings. As Quincy says, we talk just like other folk, we look just like other folk, we understand stuff, we just learn it slow. For some special ed kids, turning 18 and graduating from high school means they're on their own, sometimes without a safety net. Quincy has aged out of foster care, and Biddy discovers that her grandmother doesn't want to provide for her anymore. Fortunately, as wards of the state, both girls are eligible to participate in a program for young adults with special needs. With the support of a counselor, they will live together in an apartment. Quincy will take a job at a grocery store, and Biddy will work as a housekeeper for an elderly woman. As with Roomies, Girls Like Us uses alternating points of view to show readers how Quincy and Biddy each figure out how to function in the adult world. Part of their work is learning to perform their jobs, but the deeper journey is learning to stick up for themselves in the face of cruelty. Girls Like Us is a novel about dignity and self-worth. It's about overcoming trauma, learning to trust and depend on other people, and finding a place to belong. Before I wrap up this month's show, I want to note that even though not all teens can or should go to college, college is still the goal for the majority of our young people. Given this goal, many teens and their parents wonder what they can do to prepare. Speaking now as a college professor, I will say that the most important thing teens can do is read. In addition to novels like the ones I featured in this episode, teens should read books that fuel their interests and passions. The American Library Association provides great suggestions on their list of outstanding books for the college bound. Published by YALSA, the Young Adult Library Services Association, and revised every 5 years, this list will introduce teens to ideas and topics across a variety of academic disciplines. It's organized into categories that reflect core academic subject areas. Those include arts and humanities, history and culture, literature and language, science and technology, and social sciences. Within each category, teens will discover books in an impressive range of genres, including contemporary realistic fiction, biographies, essay collections, works of nonfiction, graphic novels, and poetry collections. Some are adult books with teen appeal, while others are written for teens themselves. The breadth of reading options here is truly wonderful. Guided by this resource, teens will strengthen their academic content knowledge and deepen their understanding of our diverse world. You can find the 2014 list at www.ala.org/YALSA. I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back to bring you books about teens overcoming obstacles and hardships. YA author Lori Holtz Anderson has recently begun calling books like these resilience literature, a term she picked up from an English teacher who taught her books Speak. I'll explore that concept, and then I'll bring you current titles that fit Lori's definition. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more text messages soon.